St. Thomas Aquinas, Part 5, Chapter 4, A Meditation on the Manichees. There is one casual anecdote about St. Thomas Aquinas which illuminates him like a lightning flash, not only without, but within. For it not only shows him as a character, even as a comedy character, and shows the colors of his period and social background, but also, as if for an instant, makes a transparency of his mind. It is a trivial incident which occurred one day, when he was reluctantly dragged from his work, and we might almost say from his play. For both were, for him, found in the unusual hobby of thinking, which is for some men a thing much more intoxicating than mere drinking. He had declined any number of society invitations to the courts of kings and princes, not because he was unfriendly, for he was not, but because he was always glowing within with the really gigantic plans of exposition and argument which filled his life. On one occasion, however, he was invited to the court of King Louis the IX of France, more famous as the Great Saint Louis, and, for some reason or other, the Dominican authorities of his order told him to accept, so he immediately did so, being an obedient friar even in his sleep, or rather in his permanent trance of reflection. It is a real case against conventional hagiography that it sometimes tends to make all saints seem to be the same, whereas, in fact, no men are more different than saints, not even murderers. And there could hardly be a more complete contrast, given the essentials of holiness, than between St. Thomas and St. Louis. St. Louis was born a knight and a king, but he was one of those men in whom a certain simplicity, combined with courage and activity, makes it natural, and in a sense easy, to fulfill directly and promptly any duty or office, however official. He was a man in whom holiness and healthiness had no quarrel, and their issue was in action. He did not go in for thinking much, in the sense of theorizing much, but, even in theory, he had that sort of presence of mind which belongs to the rare and really practical man when he has to think. He never said the wrong thing, and he was orthodox by instinct. In the old pagan proverb about kings being philosophers, or philosopher kings, there was a certain miscalculation connected with the mystery that only Christianity could reveal. For while it is possible for a king to wish much to be a saint, it is not possible for a saint to wish very much to be a king. A good man will hardly be always dreaming of being a great monarch, but, such is the liberality of the Church, that she cannot forbid even a great monarch to dream of being a good man. But Louis was a straightforward, soldierly sort of person who did not particularly mind being a king, any more than he would have minded being a captain or a sergeant or any other rank in his army. Now a man like St. Thomas would definitely dislike being a king, or being entangled with the pomp and politics of kings. Not only his humility, but a sort of subconscious fastidiousness and fine dislike of futility often found in leisure and learned men with large minds, would really have prevented him from making contact with the complexity of court life. Also, he was anxious, all his life, to keep out of politics. There was no political symbol more striking, or in a sense more challenging, at that moment, than the power of the king in Paris. Paris was truly at that time an aurora borealis, a sunrise in the north. We must realize that lands much nearer to Rome had rotted with paganism and pessimism and oriental influences, of which the most respectable was that of Mahomet. Provence and all the south had been full of a fever for nihilism or negative mysticism, and from northern France had come the spears and swords that swept away the unchristian thing. In northern France also sprang up that splendor of building that shine like swords and spears, the first spires of the Gothic. We talk now of gray Gothic buildings, but they must have been very different when they went up white and gleaming in the northern skies, partly picked out with gold and bright colors. A new flight of architecture, as startling as flying ships. The new Paris ultimately left behind by St. Louis must have been a thing white like lilies and splendid as the Oriflamme. It was the beginning of the great new thing, the nation of France, which was to pierce and overpower the old quarrel of Pope and Emperor in the lands from which Thomas came. But Thomas came very unwillingly, and, if we may say it of so kindly a man, rather sulkily. As he entered Paris, they showed him from the hill that splendor of new spires beginning, and somebody said something like, "How grand it must be to own all this." And Thomas Aquinas only muttered, "I would rather have that Chrysostom manuscript I can't get hold of." Somehow they steered that reluctant bulk of reflection to a seat in the royal banquet hall, and all we know of Thomas tells us that he was perfectly courteous to those who spoke to him, but spoke little, and was soon forgotten in the most brilliant and noisy clatter in the world, the noise of French talking. What the Frenchmen were talking about we do not know, but they forgot all about the large fat Italian in their midst, and it seems only too possible that he forgot all about them. Sudden silences will occur even in French conversation, and in one of these the interruption came. There had long been no word or motion in that huge heap of black and white weeds, like motley in mourning, which marked him as a mendicant friar out of the streets, and contrasted with all the colors and patterns and quarterings of that first and freshest dawn of chivalry and heraldry. The triangular shields and pennons and pointed spears, the triangular swords of the crusade, the pointed windows and the conical hoods, repeated everywhere that fresh French medieval spirit that did, in every sense, come to the point. But the colors of the coats were gay and varied, with little to rebuke their richness. For St. Louis, who had himself a special quality of coming to the point, had said to his courtiers, "Vanity should be avoided, but every man should dress well, in the manner of his rank, that his wife may more easily love him." And then the goblets leapt and rattled on the board of the great table shook, for the friar had brought down his huge fist like a club of stone, with a crash that startled everyone like an explosion, and he cried out in a strong voice, like the man in the grip of a dream, "And that will settle the Manichees." The palace of a king, even when it is the palace of a saint, has its conventions. A shock thrilled through the court, and everyone felt as if the fat friar from Italy had thrown a plate at St. King Louis, or knocked his crown sideways. They all looked timidly at the terrible seat that was for 1,000 years the throne of the Capets, and there they were presumably prepared to pitch the big black-robed beggar out the window. But St. Louis, simple as he seemed, was no mere medieval fountain of honor, or even fountain of mercy, but also the fountain of two eternal rivers, the irony and the courtesy of France. And he turned to his secretaries, asking them in a low voice to take their tablets around to the seat of the absent-minded conversationalist, and take a note of the argument that had just occurred to him, because it must be a very good one, and he might forget it. I have paused upon this anecdote first, as have been said, because it is the one which gives us the most vivid snapshot of a great medieval character. Indeed, of two great medieval characters. But it also specially fitted to be taken as a type of a turning point, because of the glimpse it gives of the man's main preoccupation, and the sort of thing that might have been found in his thoughts, if they had been thus surprised at any moment by a philosophical eavesdropper, or through a psychological keyhole. It was not for nothing that he was still brooding, even in the white court of St. Louis, upon the dark cloud of the Manichees. This book is meant only to be a sketch of a man, but it must at least lightly touch, later on, upon a method and a meaning, or what our journalism has an annoying way of calling a message. A very few inadequate pages must be given to the man in relation of his theology and his philosophy. But the thing of which I mean to speak here is something once more general and more personal, even than his philosophy. I have therefore introduced it here, before we come to anything like technical talk about his philosophy. It was something that might alternatively be called his moral attitude or his temperamental predisposition, or the purpose of his life so far as social and human efforts were concerned, for he knew better than most of us that there is but one purpose in this life, and it is one that is beyond this life. But if we wanted to put in a picturesque and simplified form what he wanted for the world, and what was his work in history, apart from theoretical and theological definitions, we might well say that it really was to strike a blow and settle the Manichees. The full meaning of this may not be apparent to those who do not study theological history, and perhaps even less apparent to those who do. Indeed, it may seem equally irrelevant to the history and the theology. In history, St. Dominic and Simon de Montfort, between them, had already pretty well settled the Manichees. And in theology, of course, an encyclopedic doctor, like Aquinas, dealt with 1,000 other heresies besides the Manichaean heresy. Nevertheless, it does represent his main position and the turn he gave to the whole history of Christendom. I think it well to interpose this chapter, though its scope may seem more vague than the rest, because there is a sort of big blunder about St. Thomas and his creed, which is an obstacle for most modern people in even beginning to understand them. It arises roughly thus. St. Thomas, like other monks, and especially other saints, lived a life of renunciation and austerity. His fasts, for instance, being in marked contrast to the luxury which he might have lived if he chose. This element stands high in his religion. As a matter of asserting the will against the power of nature, or thanking the Redeemer by partially sharing his sufferings, or making a man ready for anything as a missionary or martyr, and similar ideals. These happen to be rare in the modern industrial society of the West, outside his communion, and it is therefore assumed that they are the whole meaning of that communion. Because it is uncommon for an alderman to fast for 40 days, or a politician to take a Trappist vow of silence, or a man about town to live a life of strict celibacy, the average outsider is convinced not only that Catholicism is nothing except asceticism, but that asceticism is nothing except pessimism. He is so obliging as to explain to Catholics why they hold this heroic virtue in respect, and it is ever ready to point out that the philosophy behind it is an Oriental hatred of anything connected with nature, and a purely Schopenhauerian disgust with the will to live. I read in a high-class review of Miss Rebecca West's book on St. Augustine the astounding statement that the Catholic Church regards sex as having the nature of sin, how marriage can be a sacrament if sex is a sin, or why is it the Catholics who are in favor of birth and their foes who are in favor of birth control. I will leave the critic to worry out for himself. My concern is not with that part of the argument, but with another. The ordinary modern critic, seeing this aesthetic ideal in an authoritative church, and not seeing it in most other inhabitants of Brixton or Brighton, is apt to say, "This is the result of authority. It would be better to have religion without authority." But, in truth, a wider experience outside Brixton or Brighton would reveal the mistake. It is rare to find a fasting alderman or a Trappist politician, but it is still more rare to see nuns suspended in the air on hooks or spikes. It is unusual for a Catholic Evidence Guild orator in Hyde Park to begin his speech by gashing himself all over with knives. A stranger calling at an ordinary presbyter will seldom find the parish priest lying on the floor with a firelight in on his chest and scorching him while he utters spiritual ejaculations. Yet all these things are done all over Asia, for instance, by voluntary enthusiasts acting solely on the great impulse of religion. Of religion, in their case, not commonly imposed by any immediate authority, and certainly not imposed by this particular authority. In short, a real knowledge of mankind will tell anybody that religion is a very terrible thing, that it is truly a raging fire, and that authority is often quite as much needed to restrain it as to impose it. Asceticism, or the war with the appetites, is itself an appetite. it can never be eliminated from among the strange ambitions of man. But it can be kept in some reasonable control, and it is indulged in much saner proportion under the Catholic authority than in pagan or Puritan anarchy. Meanwhile, the whole of this ideal, though an essential part of Catholic idealism when it is understood, is in some ways entirely a side issue. It is not the primary principle of Catholic philosophy. It is only a particular deduction from Catholic ethics. And when we begin to talk about primary philosophy, we realize the full and flat contradiction between the monk fasting and the fakir hanging himself on hooks. Now, nobody will begin to understand the Thomist philosophy, or indeed the Catholic philosophy, who does not realize that the primary and fundamental part of it is entirely the praise of life, the praise of being, the praise of God as the creator of the world. Everything else follows a long way after that, being conditioned by various complications like the fall or the vocation of heroes. The trouble occurs because the Catholic mind moves upon two planes, that of the creation and that of the fall. The nearest parallel is, for instance, that of England invaded. There might be strict martial law in Kent, because the enemy had landed in Kent, and relative liberty in Hereford, but this would not affect the affection of an English patriot for Hereford or Kent. And strategic caution in Kent would not affect the love of Kent. For the love of England would remain, both of the parts to be redeemed by discipline and the parts to be enjoyed in liberty. Any extreme of Catholic asceticism is a wise or unwise precaution against the evil of the fall. It is never a doubt about the good of the creation, and that is where it really does differ. Nor only from rather excessive eccentricity that the gentleman who hangs himself on hooks, but from the whole cosmic story which is the hook on which he hangs. It is the case of many Oriental religions. It is really true that the asceticism is pessimism, that the ascetic tortures himself to death out of an abstract hatred of life, that he does not mean merely to control nature as he should, but to contradict nature as much as he can. And though it takes a milder form than hooks in millions of the religious populations of Asia, it is a fact far too little realized that the dogma of the denial of life really does rule as the first principle on so vast a scale. One historic form it took was that great enemy of Christianity from its beginning, the Manichees. What is called the Manichaean philosophy has had many forms. Indeed, it has attacked what is immortal and immutable with a very curious kind of immortal immutability. It is like the legend of the magician who turns himself into a snake or a cloud, and the whole has that nameless note of irresponsibility which belongs to much of the metaphysics and morals of Asia, from which the Manichaean mystery came. But it is always, in one way or another, a notion that nature is evil, or that evil is at least rooted in nature. The essential point is that as evil has roots in nature, so it has rights in nature. Wrong has as much a right to exist as right. As already stated, this notion took many forms. Sometimes it was a dualism, which made evil an equal partner with good. so that neither could be called an usurper. More often it was a general idea that demons had made the material world, and if there were any good spirits, they were concerned only with the spiritual world. Later again, it took the form of Calvinism, which held that God had indeed made the world, but in a special sense, made the evil as well as good, had made an evil will as well as an evil world. In this view, if a man chooses to damn his soul alive, he is not thwarting God's will, but rather fulfilling it. In these two forms of the early Gnosticism and the later Calvinism, we see the superficial variety and fundamental unity of Manichaeism. The old Manichaeans taught that Saran originated the whole work of creation commonly attributed to God. The new Calvinists taught that God originates the whole work of damnation commonly attributed to Saran. When look back to the first day when a devil acted like a god, the other looked forward to the last day when the god acted like a devil. But both had the idea that the creation of the earth was primarily the creator of evil, whether we call him a devil or a god. Since there are a good many Manichaeans among the moderns, as we may remark in a moment, some may agree with this view, some may be puzzled about it, some may only be puzzled about it why we should object to it. To understand the medieval controversy, a word must be said of the Catholic doctrine, which is as modern as it is medieval. That God looked upon all things and saw they were good contains a subtlety which the popular pessimist cannot follow, or is too hasty to notice. It is the thesis that there are no bad things, but only bad uses of things. If you will, there are no bad things, but only bad thoughts, especially bad intentions. Only Calvinists can really believe that hell is paved with good intentions. That is exactly the one thing it cannot be paved with. But it is possible to have bad intentions about good things. And good things, like the world and the flesh, have been twisted by a bad intention called the devil. But he cannot make things bad. They remain as on the first day of creation. The work of heaven alone was material, the making of a material world. The work of hell is entirely spiritual. This error, then, has many forms, but especially, like nearly every error, it has two forms, a fiercer one, which was outside the church and attacking the church, and a subtler one, which was inside the church and corrupting the church. There has never been a time when the church was not torn between that invasion and that treason. It was so, for instance, in the Victorian time, Darwinian competition in commerce or race conflict was every bit as brazen an atheist assault in the 19th century as the Bolshevist No God movement in the 20th century. To brag of brute prosperity, to admire the most muddy millionaires who had cornered wheat by a trick, to call about the unfit, in imitation of the scientific thinker who would just finish them off because he can't even finish his own sentence, unfit for what? All that is as simply and openly anti-Christian as the Black Mass. Yet some weak and worldly Catholics did use this cant in defense of capitalism, and their first rather feeble resistance to socialism. At least they did, until the great encyclical of the Pope on the Rights of Labor put a stop to all their nonsense. Their evil is always both within and without the Church, but in a wilder form outside and a milder form inside. So it was, again, in the 17th century, when there was Calvinism outside and Jansenism inside. So it was in the 13th century, when the obvious danger outside was in the revolution of the Albigensians, but the potential danger inside was in the very traditionalism of the Augustinians. For the Augustinians derived only from Augustine, and Augustine derived partly from Plato, and Plato was right, but not quite right. It is a mathematical fact that if a line be not perfectly directed towards a point, it will actually go further away from it as it comes nearer to it. After 1,000 years of extension, the miscalculation of Platonism had come very near to Manichaeism. Popular errors are nearly always right. They nearly always refer to some ultimate reality, about which those who correct them are themselves incorrect. It is a very queer thing that Platonic love has come to mean for the unlettered something rather purer and cleaner than it means for the learned. Yet even those who realize the great Greek evil may well realize that perversity often comes out of the wrong sort of purity. Now it was the inmost lie of the Manichaeans that they identified purity with sterility. It is singularly contrasted with the language of St. Thomas, which always connects purity with fruitfulness, whether it be natural or supernatural. And, queerly enough, as I have said, there does remain a sort of reality in the vulgar colloquialism that the affair between Sam and Susan is quite Platonic. It is true that, quite apart from the local perversion, there was in Plato a sort of idea that people would be better without their bodies, that their heads might fly off and meet in the sky in merely intellectual marriage, like cherubs in a picture. The ultimate phase of the Platonic philosophy was what inflamed poor D.H. Lawrence into talking nonsense, and he was probably unaware that the Catholic doctrine of marriage would say much of what he said without talking nonsense. Anyhow, it is historically important to see that Platonic love did somewhat distort both human and divine love. In the theory of the early theologians, many medieval men who would indignantly deny the Albigensian doctrine of sterility were yet in an emotional mood to abandon the body in despair, and some of them to abandon everything in despair. In truth, this vividly illuminates the provincial stupidity of those who object to what they call creeds and dogmas. It was precisely the creed and dogma that saved the sanity of the world. These people generally propose an alternative religion of intuition and feeling. If, in the really dark ages, there had been a religion of feeling, it would have been a religion of black and suicidal feeling. It was the rigid creed that resisted the rush of suicidal feeling. The critics of asceticism are probably right in supposing that many a Western hermit did feel rather like an Eastern fakir. But he could not really think like an Eastern fakir, because he was more an Orthodox Catholic. And what kept his thought in touch with healthier and more humanistic thought was simply and solely the dogma. He could not deny that a good God had created the normal and natural world. He could not say that the devil had made the world, because he was not a Manichee. 1,000 enthusiasts for celibacy in the day of the great rush to the desert or the cloister might have called marriage of sin, if they had only considered their individual ideals in the modern manner and in their immediate feelings about marriage. Fortunately, they had to accept the authority of the Church, which had definitely said that marriage was not a sin. A modern emotional religion might at any moment have turned Catholicism into Manichaeism, but when religion would have maddened men, theology kept them sane. In this sense, St. Thomas stands up simply as the great Orthodox theologian who reminds men of the creed of creation when many of them were still in the mood of mere destruction. It is futile for the critics of medievalism to quote 100 medieval phrases that may be supposed to sound like mere pessimism if they will not understand the central fact that medieval men did not care about being medieval and did not accept the authority of a mood because it was melancholy, but did care very much about orthodoxy, which is not a mood. It was because St. Thomas could prove that his glorification of the Creator and his creative joy was more orthodox than any atmospheric pessimism, that he dominated the Church and the world, which accepted the truth as a test. But when this immense and personal importance is allowed for, we may agree that there was a personal element as well. Like most of the great religious leaders, he was fitted individually for the task that God had given him to do. If we can, like, call that talent instinctive, we can even descend to calling it temperamental. Anybody trying to popularize a medieval philosopher must use language that is very modern and very unphilosophical. Nor is this a sneer at modernity. It arises from the moderns having dealt so much in moods and emotions, especially in the arts, that they have developed a large but loose vocabulary which deals more with an atmosphere than with actual attitude or position. As noted elsewhere, even the modern philosophers are more like the modern poets, in giving an individual tinge even to truth, and often looking at all life through different colored spectacles. To say that Schopenhauer had the blues, or that William James had a rather rosier outlook, would often convey more than calling the one a pessimist and the other a pragmatist. This modern moodiness has its value, though the moderns overrate it, just as medieval logic has its value, though it was overrated in the Middle Ages. But the point is that to explain the medievals to the moderns, we must use this modern language of mood. Otherwise, the character will be missed through certain prejudices and ignorances about all such medieval characters. Now there is something that lies all over the work of St. Thomas Aquinas, like a great light, which is something quite primary and perhaps unconscious with him, which he would perhaps have passed over as an irrelevant personal quality, and which can now only be expressed by a rather cheap journalistic term, which he probably would have thought quite senseless. Nevertheless, the only working word for that atmosphere is optimism. I know that the word is now even more degraded in the 20th century than it was in the 19th century. Men talked lately of being optimists about the issue of war, They now talk of being optimists about the revival of trade. They may talk tomorrow of being optimists about the international ping-pong tournament. But men in the Victorian time did mean a little more than that. When they used the word optimist of Browning or Stevenson or Walt Whitman, and in a rather larger and more luminous sense than in the case of these men, the term was basically true of Thomas Aquinas. He did, with a most solid and colossal conviction, believe in life, and in something like what Stevenson called the great theorem of livableness of life. It breathes somehow in his first phrases about the reality of being. If the morbid Renaissance intellectual is supposed to say, "To be or not to be, that is the question," then the massive medieval doctor does most certainly reply in a voice of thunder, "To be, that is the answer." The point is important. Many not unnaturally talk of the Renaissance as a time when certain men began to believe in life. The truth is that it was time when a few men, for the first time, began to disbelieve in life. The medievals had put many restrictions, and some excessive restrictions, upon the universal human hunger and even fury for life. Those restrictions had often been expressed in fanatical and rabid terms, the terms of those resisting a great natural force, a force of men who desired to live. Never until modern thought began did they really have to fight with men who deserved to die. That horror had threatened them in Asiatic Albigensianism, but it never became normal to them until now. But this fact becomes very vivid indeed when we compare the greatest of Christian philosophers with the only men who were anything like his equals or capable of being his rivals. They were people with whom he did not directly dispute. Most of them he had never seen. Some of them he had never heard of. Plato and Augustine were only two with whom he could confer, as he did with Bonaventure or even Averroes. We must look elsewhere for his real rivals, and the only real rivals of the Catholic theory. There are heads of great heathen systems, some of them very ancient, some very modern, like Buddha on one hand or Nietzsche on the other. It is when we see this gigantic figure against this vast and common background that we realize, first, that he was only optimist theologian, and second, that Catholicism is the only optimist theology. Something milder and even more amiable may be made out of the deliquescence of theology and the mixture of the creed with everything that contradicts it, but among consistent cosmic creeds, this is the only one that is entirely on the side of life. Comparative religion has indeed allowed us to compare religions and to contrast them. 50 years ago, it set out to prove that all religions were much the same, generally proving, alternately, that they were all equally worthy and that they were all equally worthless. Since then, this scientific process has suddenly begun to be scientific and discovered the depths of the chasms as well as the heights of the hills. It is indeed an excellent improvement that since sincerely religious people should respect each other. But respect has discovered difference, where contempt knew only indifference. The more we really appreciate the noble revulsion and renunciation of Buddha, The more we see that intellectually it was the converse, and almost the contrary, of the salvation of the world by Christ. The Christian would escape from the world to see into the universe. The Buddhist wishes to escape from the universe even more than from the world. One would uncreate himself, the other would return to his creation, to his creator. Indeed, it was so genuinely the converse of the idea of the cross as the tree of life, that there is some excuse for setting up the two things side by side, as if they were of equal significance. They are in one sense parallel and equal, as a mound and a hollow, as a hill and a valley. There is a sense in which that sublime despair is the only alternative to that divine audacity. It is even true that the truly spiritual and intellectual man sees it as a sort of dilemma, a very hard and terrible choice. There is little else on earth that can compare with these for completeness, and he who will not climb the mountain of Christ does indeed fall into the abyss of Buddha. The same is true, in a less and dignified fashion, of most other alternatives of heathen humanity. Nearly all are sucked back into that whirlpool of recurrence which all the ancients knew. Nearly all return to the one idea of returning. That is what Buddha describes so darkly as the sorrowful wheel. It is true that the sort of recurrence which Buddha described as the sorrowful wheel, poor Nietzsche actually managed to describe as the joyful wisdom. I can only say that if bare repetition was his idea of joyful wisdom, I should be curious to know which was his idea of sorrowful wisdom. But as a fact, in the case of Nietzsche, this did not belong to the moment of his breaking out, but to a moment of his breaking down. It came at the end of his life, when he was near to mental collapse, and it is really quite contrary to his earlier and finer inspirations of wild freedom or fresh and creative innovation. Once at least he tried to break out, but also has only broken on the wheel. Alone upon the earth, and lifted and liberated from all the wheels and whirlpools of the earth, stands up the faith of St. Thomas, weighted and balanced indeed, with more than oriental metaphysics and more than pagan pomp and pageantry, but vitally and vividly alone in declaring that life is a living story, with a great beginning and a great close. Rooted in the primeval joy of God and finding its fruition in the final happiness of humanity, opening with the colossal chorus in which the sons of God shouted for joy, and ending in that mystical comradeship shown in a shadowy fashion in those ancient words that move like an archaic dance, "For his delight is with the sons of men." It is the fate of this sketch to be sketchy about philosophy, scanty or rather empty about theology, and to achieve little more than a decent silence on the subject of sanctity. And yet, it must nonetheless be the recurrent burden of this little book, to which it must return with some monotony, that in this story the philosophy did depend on the theology, and the theology did depend on the sanctity. In other words, it must repeat the first fact, which was emphasized in the first chapter, that this great intellectual creation was a Christian and Catholic creation, and cannot be understood as anything else. It was Aquinas who baptized Aristotle, when Aristotle could not have baptized Aquinas. It was a purely Christian miracle which raised the great pagan from the dead. And this is proved in three ways, as St. Thomas himself might say, which it will be well to summarize as a sort of summary of this book. First, in the life of St. Thomas, it is proved in the fact that only his huge and solid orthodoxy could have supported so many things which then seemed to be unorthodox. Charity covers a multitude of sins, and in that sense orthodoxy covers a multitude of heresies, or things which are hastily mistaken for heresies. It was precisely because his personal Catholicism was so convincing that his impersonal Aristotelianism was given the benefit of the doubt. He did not smell of the faggot because he did not smell of the firebrand. Of the firebrand he had so instantly and instinctively snatched up, under a real assault on essential Catholic ethics. A typically cynical modern phrase refers to the man who is so good that he is good for nothing. St. Thomas was so good that he was good for everything, that his warrant held good for what others considered the most wild and daring speculations, ending in the worship of nothing. Whether he or no he baptized Aristotle, he was truly the godfather of Aristotle, he was his sponsor, he swore that the old Greek would do no harm, and the whole world trusted his word. Second, in the philosophy of St. Thomas, it is proved by the fact that everything depended on the new Christian motive for the study of facts, as distinct from truths. The Thomist philosophy began with the lowest roots of thought, the senses and the truisms of the reason, and a pagan sage might have scorned such things as he scorned the servile arts. But the materialism, which is mere cynicism in a pagan, can be Christian humility in a Christian. St. Thomas was willing to begin by recording the facts and sensations of the material world, just as he would have been willing to begin by washing up the plates and dishes in the monastery. The point of his Aristotelianism is that even if common sense about concrete things really was a sort of servile labor, he must not be ashamed to be servus servorum Dei. Among heathens, the mere skeptic might become the mere cynic. Diogenes, in his tub, had always a touch of the tub-thumper. But even the dirt of the cynics was signified into dust and ashes among the saints. If we miss that, we miss the whole meaning of the greatest revolution in history. There was a new motive for beginning with the most material, and even with the meanest things. Third, in the theology of St. Thomas, it is proved by tremendous truth that support all that theology, or any other Christian theology, there really was a new reason for regarding the senses and the sensations of the body and the experiences of the common man, with a reverence at which Aristotle would have stared, and no man in the ancient world could have begun to understand. The body was no longer what it was when Plato and Porphyry and the old mystics had left it for dead. It had hung upon a gibbet. It had risen from a tomb. It was no longer possible for the soul to despise the senses, which had been the organs of something that was more than man. Plato might despise the flesh, but God had not despised it. The senses had truly become sanctified, as they are blessed one by one at a Catholic baptism. Seeing is believing, was no longer the platitude of a mere idiot or a common individual, as in Plato's world. It was mixed up with real conditions of real belief, those revolving mirrors that send messages to the brain of man, that light that breaks upon the brain. These had truly revealed to God himself the path to Bethany, or the light on the high rock of Jerusalem. These ears that resound with common noises had reported also to the secret knowledge of God the noise of the crowd that strewed palms and the crowd that cried for crucifixion. After the incarnation had become the idea that is central in our civilization, it was inevitable that there should be a return to materialism, in the sense that the serious value of matter and the making of the body. When once Christ had risen, it was inevitable that Aristotle should rise again. Those are three real reasons, and very sufficient reasons, for the general support given by the saint to a solid and objective philosophy. Yet there was something else, very vast and vague, to which I have tried to give a faint expression by the interposition of this chapter. It is difficult to express it fully without the awful parallel of being popular, or what the modernists quite wrongly imagine to be popular. In short, passing from religion to religiosity. But there is a general tone and temper of Aquinas, which it is as difficult to avoid as daylight in a great house of windows. It is that positive position of his mind, which is filled and soaked as with sunshine with the warmth of the wonder of created things. There is a certain private audacity in his communion by which men add to their private names the tremendous titles of the Trinity and the Redemption, so that none may be called of the Holy Ghost, or a man bear such a burden as the title of Saint John of the Cross. In this sense, the man we study may specially be called Saint Thomas the Creator. The Arabs have a phrase about the 100 names of God, but they also inherit the tradition of a tremendous name unspeakable because it expresses being itself, dumb and yet dreadful as an instant inaudible shout. The proclamation of the absolute. And perhaps no other man ever came so near to calling the Creator by his own name, which can only be written, I am.